Okay, today is the 4th of September, 2007, and we are at the Henry Johnson Charter School in Albany, New York, and we are doing an interview with Mr. William Aiello, and the interviewer is Wayne Clark. And sir, for the record, please state your full name and your date of birth.
William Patrick Aiello, 16 March 1949.
Okay, and whereabouts were you born?
Brooklyn, New York. Adelphi Hospital.
Okay. And did you attend school there?
No, I attended Sachem High School in Lake Ron Conkema, New York, where I grew up.
Okay. And when and where did you enter the service?
I entered the Marine Corps in Fort Hamilton, New York, in Brooklyn, in 25 June 1967.
Were you drafted or did you
enlist? I enlisted.
Okay. And where did you go for your basic training?
Parris Island, South Carolina.
And was that your first time away from home?
First plane ride, first time away from home, yes, sir.
Okay, and was it a rude awakening for you?
Yes, it was. I never forget the moment we got there. Nobody ever does anything.
Uh-huh. And how long was that basic?
Boot camp was, I got there the end of June, we graduated August. And what they did, which people tend to forget, is prior to Vietnam you had a 12-week recruit training. During the war they reduced it, the length, but not the training. So in other words, prior to Vietnam you had Sundays off at Parris Island, if you could call whatever they did off, which I'm sure wasn't nice. But we didn't have Sundays off. Parris Island, and we trained later and longer to get in the mandatory subjects. And what would be a mandatory subject at Parris Island? You know, 90 hours of history and traditions, you know you were going to get that. Drill and ceremony, you know you're going to get that. You were going to be on the rifle range for 2 weeks. You those things you've got. They probably skimped on things like junk on the bunks, things on the springs, because they figured you would get that down the road. And basically that's what they did.
Okay. And after your basic, where did you go?
We reported to Camp Pendleton, California, to what they call Staging Battalion. And you'd go through an additional 30 days of training. And basically it was training gauge to Vietnam. Well, as you were, right? I take that way. First I went to Camp Geiger for infantry training. And then, you know, you go home on leave, and then, well, you go to, on your way to Vietnam, you go to Staging Battalion, and that is gauged to that. And then you're waiting for shipment, and then we shipped out, and we went to Okinawa, dumped our gear, and then we went to Vietnam, landed in Da Nang, and the honeymoon began.
You went over on a commercial flight?
Yes. And the first thing we did is we left on Thanksgiving Day from El Toro Air Force Base, El Toro Marine Air Station, which is no longer in existence, which I feel bad about. But El Toro, we got there on Thanksgiving. And you know, in the service, Thanksgiving is always a huge holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So we're there, and all the officers and the senior NCOs are in their dress blues, and the wives are there, and they're all in their best garments, and everybody's having a nice meal. And all of a sudden, we walked in, and it was dead silence. And you being in the service, you know, people on mess duty and cooks don't like you anyway. They gave us so much food, and they kept on piling it up because they knew we were where we were going. And when we got back to the barracks, which was kind of strange because we were segregated, isolated, and they actually locked us in, like we were going to go somewhere. And then we got on the cattle cars to go to the airstrip, and we got there, and it was very funny. We had to line up, and we went alphabetically, and the stewardess called off your name, and you had to run up to the stewardess. You know, it was just like reporting your drill instructor, because most of us, that's who we just got reporting from. And then you ran up to the plane. And in the old days, all the lower enlisted, as you know, got to the back of the plane. Later on, I guess they moved everybody to the front when they found out it was safer for you to be in the back. But yeah, and then we landed in Okinawa, and then we went to Vietnam.
Okay. When you stepped off the plane in Vietnam, what was your impression?
Oh, besides being a scared little puppy, yeah, big time. And, you know, it was kind of almost dawn, but not quite. And the way Da Nang worked is, and I'm sure because you and I caught, planes didn't stay on the ground. And you got off, and the guys going home came right up, and the plane took off. And you'd hear catcalls from the guys. Hey, you're not going to make it. Ha, ha, hey, nobody. And, you know, the standard stuff mm-hmm. that goes on. And then you'd come down, and you were scared, and you'd see what you thought was probably, you know, a half a click away, which was probably seven, you know, illumination and outgoing, and you had no idea what it was. And then you got on cattle cars, and you're driving to where you were going to get processed, and the guys in Da Nang were taking PT tests. I always thought that was funny.
And where was your destination once you left Da Nang?
I got assigned to Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 26th Marine Regiment, 3rd Marine Division. And battalion rear, you know, and then we get into the infamous rear, forward rear, and then finally where you had to go, was in Fubai. And we flew up to Fubai, and thank God, because, you know, the Marine Corps is a little bit different, I think, than the other services. Is we turned in our paperwork, we stood around for what we thought were hours. It was probably an hour and a half. And the guy just threw this manila envelope. We yelled out your name, and it had a letter on it and a number. And in my case, it said 3/26. And that's where you went. And then you'd have to say, how do I get there? And they'd say, go to the airstrip. Well, then you had to go find out where the airstrip was and customer service and all those things. And luckily, you know, being good privates, you hucked on to some poor sergeant or corporal. And they got you there. And when we got there, we landed in Fubai. There was a sergeant there. He called up. A jeep came for the sergeant. And about half an hour after that, a deuce and a half came for us. And then we reported to the battalion where they gave us our equipment. And they told us we would be leaving, you know, next day, which I always remembered when they gave us the equipment was, the guy gave me a helmet, and it was obviously a bullet hole went in this way, and then the ugly part of the bullet hole came out that way. And that's the first time in the Marine Corps I told somebody, no, I don't want this. I mean, the supply said, what do you don't want this for? I said, obviously it wasn't lucky for this guy. I don't really need that. So I got a new helmet. And the next day we convoyed up to Camp Evans. Mm-hmm. Which, as you know, is north of Fubai, south of Wei. And I was a machine gunner, and Marine Corps machine gunning still an MOS. So he asked for machine gunners, and he put me on a 50 caliber. So I'm on a 50 caliber, and it's on a D-ring on the truck. And you know how that goes, and it's very hell, circling. That thing beat me up. I'm telling you, I held on to it. It was the monsoon season, so it's raining, and the only thing we have is a poncho, and we still have a stateside utilities on, and you know, that just soaked up the rain and never let it go anywhere. And we finally got there, and it seemed like, you know, all day. And we poured it out, and we went into the S1 tent, and there's always some clerk, who says, yeah, and you guys better not want me to ever see your name again. And this kid is a PFC, and then in the Marine Corps, a PFC is an E2. Well, you know, we're all PFCs. And so, being a wise guy from New York, I said, yeah, and why is that? He says, because I'm the guy who sends the letters home that you died. So, somewhere in my mind, I said, someday I'm going to see that fellow again. And then I reported into the, we got signed to the companies, and I was the only guy who went to Lima Company. Most of the other guys went to my company, because my company had gotten into a big fight up in Contienda doing Operation Buffalo, and they were just getting the replacements, and we were those replacements. And I went to Lima Company. And, you know, the first sergeant gives the traditional, this is how it is, speech. And the supply sergeant was standing there, and all of a sudden, the speech was over. So as everybody who's been in the service knows, all right, the first sergeant is done, it's now time for you to leave. And I said, excuse me, and I got to look like, what are you doing? And I said, I'm supposed to sign something. He goes, what do you mean you're supposed to sign something? I said, my brother's in Special Forces in B-52 here in Vietnam. And the sergeant major, Cam Pendleton, called me in, and he said that that I wasn't going, and I said I wanted to go, and which was stupid, but you know how to go. So, making a long story short, the first, but he said I had to sign some form. He said I'd sign it in Okinawa or I'd sign it here. And the first sergeant said, oh my God. And being a first sergeant, he knew what was going on. And he said, ooh. He said, don't worry, kid, we'll make you a company driver. You know, there's no such thing as a company driver in an infantry company, but that's okay. So I went. And when the first sergeant left, a year later, I said, hey, first sergeant, where's the form? I never signed it. I still have it. But yeah, it was a... Then I got assigned to a platoon, and I met one of the guys who got wounded during Operation Buffalo, you know, which was the big battle of Cantien, and Tim Kuhlein, good man. And I was in his squad, and he took good care of me when I got there. And you know how you imitate everybody, especially when you're the brand new guy. So he put his stuff up on these. We were in tents, and they had wooden structures. Wooden supports. So he put this thing up. So being I had put it up there. Well, we'd go to sleep that night, and little do I realize, incoming from outgoing, nobody knows what incoming and outgoing is. All of a sudden, our shoulder goes off, and oh my God, I got hit. And I know my head is concave. I just know it's concave. And I'm bleeding like a bit. And I'm trying to wake up Tim. God bless Tim. Tim's back from the hospital. He's in the rear. He's drunk. He ain't getting up on nobody. So I crawl out, and you remember how it was all lousy red clay and little pebbles in that area. So I'm cutting up my feet, and I just kind of remember where the corpsman's tent is, and I burst in there, and I say, I'm hit, and the guy opens up. He looks at me and watches me. He says, yeah, I think I got 4 stitches, which is up here. And I said, gee, my first night in my unit, and I'm in the rear, and I got one. This is going to be a long tour. And I lay back into my bunk, and I'm saying, what's going to happen? And I go, ow. And it turns out, what was it? My helmet. I had put my helmet up there earlier in the day. I went into bed, and when the outgoing artillery from our own artillery pieces fired, you know how it vibrates, and my helmet hit me. So that was my big... I think that's fine.
Okay, and when was the first time you were under fire?
Actually, the next day we went out to the Kobe-Tonton Valley, which was a area in the flatlands outside of LZ Evans that went to the mountains, and the enemy had used it to infiltrate. So the battalion was out there operating. So I went out there, you know, and you're the new guy. So what did I know? I made a field transport pack. You know, so I looked shades of World War II, you know, making the big beach landing. And of course, I've got 5 gallons of water and a case of sea rations besides my rifle. So we get up, we get on the helicopter, then we get off the helicopter at the LZ battalion. And then, you know, a patrol from the company came up, we go through that. And you know what happens. You see a guy fall or trip, you fall or trip, because obviously he knows what he's doing. So we finally get there. And we get to the thing, and I get into the company, and I get sent to the platoon, and I'm beat already. And all of a sudden, my squad leader, Steve Penner, says to me, he gives me how the world's going to be, and that's fine. And next thing you know, he tells me, go see the platoon sergeant for a TRE. So I'm a brand new private. I go running straight up to the platoon sergeant. I said, sir, and he goes, what? And I said, I need a TRE. And he said, boy. Staff Sergeant James, great guy. What does T-R-E-E spell? And I said, tree. And he says, tell your squad leader I want to see him. I never forget that. Yeah. And then so I get out to the position. And, you know, they had always told you, remember that from training, that if you come into a position that's already been used, you check it out for booby traps. So the guys had been in this machine gun position for probably 2 days, and it was an old machine gun position from some other unit, probably a year or two earlier. But since they were short, they didn't have a full four-man gun team. So I get there, and of course I do what you're supposed to do. I lay flat, I take my rifle, and I hit the bottom. Lo and behold, it's a punchy pit. And it swings open, and you know, there's punchy sticks there. I'm very lucky because I'm stupid, I'm a newbie. The old guys were very lucky because they didn't have enough guys to get into that other position. So that's okay. So then I get to make clear fields of fire, you know, how you clear fields. So they give me the machetes, and I'm there, and you know, the machete's winning, I'm not. I'm getting beat up by the machete as you're swinging. Right? All of a sudden I'm swinging and swinging. Next thing you know, I fall, and I land up in the ground, about 6 feet down. Machete's over there, and I go, oh my God, and all I know is I see a towel and a grapefruit. Sound familiar? Town and grapefruit, and it's over there. And I go, oh my God. And I go grabbing for it, and I can't. I get it, because I thought it was all over. I must have scared the guy, or he was gone, but anyway, when I went, so once I composed myself, I very warmed up, and I told him, let's see if I found a spider trap out there. You know, my check. Yeah, but yeah, it was very funny. But then we moved out the next night. The next day we were moving out. And it was the first time I used sea stags. You remember the sea stag, the big Marine Corps helicopter. So what's the worst thing in the world to be is the last squad to be taken out of an LZ. You know that as well. But with the Sea Stallion, they can take a whole platoon out. And so it's a lot easier. So the Sea Stallion comes in, and you know, the perimeter continually gets very small. I was very lucky. The unit I was in was very, very good at what they did. So that always helped. So you learn just by osmosis, as you know, but the perimeter keeps on getting smaller and smaller, so that you, for the number of people you have, you can protect it. So now we all get on the helicopter, and just as the helicopter is lifting, went like that, all hell breaks loose. And all I know is they say, stick your rifle out, because, you know, the Sea Stallion has the big windows. So we put it out, and we were firing, and they were firing at us, and I was putting, and we just laid fire, and that's exactly as we took off. That's the first time I ever got shot at. And I know I didn't have anything. I'd be lucky if I hit the ground, you know what I mean? But it was fun. I was scared. Mm-hmm.
And when did you get sent to Khe Sanh?
Well, we went back to Evans, you know, and we were preparing to move up to C2. We were going to go to C2. C2 was an outpost up on the Z. We were going to go there. We were supposed to stay there until Christmas Day, then we were going to move back to on Christmas Day, because there was going to be some kind of big operation. But what happened was we got to Quang Tri, and the battalion headquarters was going to be at Quang Tri. So we took a convoy from Evans to Quang Tri, and you know, it's the typical service. We're moving up, and we finally get there, and all of a sudden, everybody else has got a hardback, and you remember what the hardbacks are, those permanent structures, except my platoon, and we got to set up tents, one big GP medium. So we just finished putting up the GP medium, and all of a sudden I start yelling, Task Force Kotel X-rays, and I have no idea what that is. Why do I know? You know, you're a private, you know, I've been there about 2 weeks, you just follow what? And they said, come on. So we load up on this garbage truck. It wasn't even a deuce thing, it was a garbage truck. And I looked at Steve Penn, and I said, what's this? He says, Saigon's being overrun. What? And this is before Christmas Eve. What are we talking about? And I'm scared. So next thing you know, we get to the airstrip, but our truck turns over because the truck, you know, the mud, you know, the mud section, it's just terrible. So the mud flipped over, and we lost, nobody got killed, but some people like broke legs and arms. But, you know, luckily I had that field transport back, you know, and it fell off, so I didn't get hurt. And we get on the chopper and we fly out. And you've been to Khe Sanh, and you know it's a whole different world. I thought we were flying forever, and next thing you know, we land. And I thought I was in Korea, it was so cold. I mean, people don't understand how cold it gets at Khe Sanh. I mean, you know, you're used to 120 degrees, and next thing you know, it's 70. That's cold. And I did, no, and then somebody said, I said, gee, where are we? And they said, we're at Khe Sanh. And I said, oh. He says, you know what that means? And I said, no. And he said, that means the wagon of the dead. I said, oh. And that we stayed there that day, that night. The next morning we moved out and we went on an operation. And we went to Hill 980, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, we were doing sweeps. And I never forget, we dug in that night, and we counted. That's the first time I saw the torches the enemy carried, first time. And there were literally hundreds of them. And all we did was just watch and count. It's very scary. And yeah, you know, they called an artillery and stuff like that. But yeah, and Tim Kuehlein, God bless him, you know, it's true. It's just how it was. Tim Kuehlein, God bless him, from Michigan, he had a canteen. He says, "Here, Bill, take this." I said, "No, I have one." He says, "No, take this." It was whiskey. God bless him. He just like the movies. He had a canteen of water and he had one canteen of whiskey. That's just how Tim was. So anyway, we did that. Then we moved back and we ran into a recon team that was down in the gully. And we made our way back to Quezon. And we were there and they moved our position to another area. Well, I guess we moved about three or four times our position at Quezon base itself proper. And all of a sudden, Christmas Eve, the 3rd platoon shot those 6 guys. And Lieutenant Buffington, who was the company executive officer, went out with the REACT force. And these are the guys that had all the plans on them. So Christmas Eve of 1967, when 3rd Platoon opened up on these guys and killed them, and Lieutenant Buffington went out. Captain Camp was the company commander. He's an author now, and he's a historian at Quantico, Virginia. He was company commander. He sent Lieutenant Buffington out, and that's when I found all the map cases and all the information about the siege that was coming. So they knew then, and because I know the next day Westmoreland flew in. Not that was a big deal to us, but I mean you're probably private there, but he flew in, and that's when they knew something was coming. They knew then. And I guess it confirmed reports that they had earlier from all sorts of different sources. Well, you know, you're dumb going. And then they changed us around again. You know, they kept on changing our positions around. 3 companies went up to 881 and 861. That would be Kilo, Mike, and India. We stayed at Quezon Combat Base. I never forget, we were on the perimeter one that night, and all of a sudden, guys came in behind us. And where we had been before. And later that morning, I found out that they were the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, the Walking Dead. Great unit. So all these short timers we had, that even up to this point, weren't really caring about anything. They were seen going home. That's all they cared about. So when I woke the guys up that morning, and you know, from watch for stand two, you know, because in the Marine Corps you do stand two all the time, you know. And I said, "Yeah, we had a unit coming behind us now." And he said, "What's that? Who are they?" And I said, 1-9. And this corporal, God bless him, he started cleaning his rifle, and the next thing you know, he was all business because he knew with the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines there, we were going to get hit. And he was very, very accurate about that. And yeah, so I stayed there during the siege, and I got wounded there, and I then we took...
Let me ask you this, how were you wounded, shrapnel or... Bullet?
Yeah, I know what it was I don't know if you're familiar with the topography of Quezon. There was the Montagnard village, and I had a 50 caliber position. I think they put a number on it, 101, which is the other interesting thing, you know, allegedly, what do I know? But allegedly, Lyndon Page Johnson would walk at night, and he would go down to the sandbox of Quezon. We had all these positions outlined, and we had little numbers on our positions. Mine was 101. I never forget that one. And allegedly, Johnson would watch and look at that. I no wonder the man had a nervous breakdown. But yeah, he would look at this. And it was where the road was coming to. So if the road was this way, you know, we were right here, and we had the 50 caliber. The Brew Village was over here, and the SF compound, the Special Forces compound, was over here, and the main gate was there, which was always, you know, secure. And the next position over was an anti-tank position, And we worked in unison, if in tank, because the only way the tanks could come is if they came this way, and everybody knew that. And we had the 25th Chemical Company come from Korea, of all places. They laid the mines. That was another joke. I always loved that about, you know, the engineers lay mines, but you know who dig the holes for the engineers? The grunts. So you'd have to dig these holes so they could put the mines in. You know, they couldn't dig the holes, but yeah. But anyway, so they did that. We had a lot of anti-personnel mines, anti-tank mines in front of us, and thank God. My position alone had 15 claymores. And then we had the Imperial Japanese Marine Corps, because every hole had a claymore that the last man alive before it was overrun was to use it. It was always to blow up the hole. Needless to say, thank God that never happened. But mm-hmm. we had, and that was it. And God bless us, nobody ever had to see if we were going to play that, but we had to. Anyway, so the Brew Village was right there. And I would maybe it's as far away as that skyscraper right there. And what happened was, earlier that day, we had seen them moving into the village, and the snipers went in. They went to the positions and we couldn't find them. Work detail, a guy had dropped some wire, and they said, let's give the guy a hand. And what happened was they had snipers, the enemy snipers in there using mortars, and we were just a target of opportunity. They dropped a mortar on us. Gary Neely got wounded really bad. The guy who was doing the initial work detail, he got wounded really bad. Tim Kuhlein got wounded really bad, and I got hit in the head. And Corporal Boone, great guy, said, come on, Bill, the guys are hurt. So we went and we got them out. We picked them up, we ran them into the hole. Tim, Gary Neely, and this other guy, we got them in the hole. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like firemen and policemen. You never have enough corpsmen, you have too many. Right away, all the corpsmen from the platoon got there, and that was great. And so they're taken care of. The guy, so I go into the whole position, and I start to smoke a cigarette, and I go, gee. Then, you know, the next thing you know, Lieutenant Madison comes in, and he says to the doc, who, young doc, new guy, and he was just looking at me. He didn't say anything, he was looking at me. And he said, anybody else hit? And he's looking at me, and he sees me. And I was just scratching my head because it hurt. But see, when I initially got hit, it felt, you know, that's the way everybody gets hit. You know, I mean, I felt heat, a light, and I was on my back. And when Corporal Boone had said, Bill, that snapped me out of whatever I was doing. So I said, no, it's just bleeding, sir. It's okay. He says to Doc, put him on a casualty list and go to battalion aid. So I went to the battalion aid station, and there were a lot of wounded. And if I said there were 20, there might have been 30, or there could have been 12. But there was a lot of guys in this bunker. And they were all wounded. And the docs were, we had one battalion, the battalion surgeon, and the corpsman at the battalion aid station. And they were working on them. And I never forget, I look in and I see Tim. By now, Tim has been initially taken care of. And Tim is as high as a Georgia pine on the morphine. And he just said, hey, Bill, tell the guys morphine is better than pot. I love that line. To this day, I thought that was the greatest line I ever heard in the whole war. So I go there, and because I was hit in the head, and it wasn't serious, so anybody, you know, wasn't serious, said, all right, we can't give you anything because it's a head wound. So they put a corpsman here, corpsman here, corpsman on my arm here, corpsman on my arm here, another corpsman holding on my head. And they put that towel on, you know, with the hole in it where they're going to do it. So they start pulling, and it obviously it wasn't a bad one, but you know, I would feel once they were pulling the shrapnel out, you'd feel it pulling. So, and by this time, I just want to go to sleep. You know, you're a dumb grunt, you know, hey, I can go to sleep. They wouldn't let me go to sleep and hold my head up. That's fine, so they're pulling the stuff out. Then they say, okay, they start stitching me up. And the head corpsman says to the doc, oh, Doc, why don't you do this kind of stitch? I said, excuse me, a plain one will be all right. And the doctor said, there's enough cooks in this broth. You just shut up. So they stitched me up. And I go, they put me over where the other guys are. So I say, hey, great, I'm going to get a full night's sleep. Boom. And next thing you know, a guy comes through the flap at the bunk and says, all walking wounded, back to your positions. They're coming. So I go back, along with a bunch of other guys. So it wasn't like I was the only thing guy. And we get there. And luckily, it was a very uneventful night. It just warm, like most of those nights. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And then we went to, we did the siege. Major Caulfield was the S3. He later became a major general, a good man. And he came from Long Island, different part of Long Island than I did. He came from Bayshore. And he came when we'd always have to redo the holes because they'd always check. And I remember Major Caulfield saying, we just finished digging a hole this time. It was, we thought it was perfect. He said, now you got to move it a little bit more this way. You know, what are you going to tell a major? You know, just like, and he says, you're from Long Island. Yes, sir. And he says, remember, you're too smart to get hit. Yes, sir. And of course, that night I got hit. Then he came back the next morning. He says, I'm not going to tell you that anymore. Okay. And my platoon sergeant and my platoon leader, Lieutenant Maslin, Lieutenant Staff Sergeant James, and our platoon guide, and I forget his name, great guys. I mean, at the time I didn't think they were great guys, but they were. They really cared about us. Then we did the siege, and I guess the strangest thing was our colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Studd, S-T-U-D-T, the best officer I ever spent in all my 24 years in the service, by the way. Best, bar none. He had us go out on an ambush. Now, two-thirds of the platoon, Lieutenant Madison Leonard, you know, he's a 21, 22-year-old person, you know. Then he was old to an 18-year-old kid like we all were, but geez. You're 22-year-old, and this is a big burden on this guy's shoulder if you look at it. And it's a patrol where we're supposed to be, in reality, the early warning system. We're going to go out by the drop zone, set in, at this likely avenue approach where a regiment is supposed to come and hit the base at. And we're supposed to initiate an ambush. So, you know, we do the rehearsal like we always did. You know, God bless the Marine Corps, we would do that. So we went through the rehearsal and we did all that. Then they said, we're going to have communion, you know. So Father came and gave a service. And I never forget it. We were in a bomb crater. And I was the altar boy, which I thought was cool. And all of a sudden, in his sermon, he said this. He said, "We are dead even to sin, but not to God." And I guess that summed up Kasan. But, and then we passed around the, we had the communion, then we passed around the wine, and the father was expecting to have any wine to finish. That didn't happen. And then we went back, and, you know, it was just like, I hate to repeat it, but it was just like the movies. Guys who were owed $5 to all of a sudden people who weren't going on patrol were giving them $5. Like, you've got to spend that MPC, the funny money, where were we going to spend it anyway? But, yeah. So we went out that night, and we set in, and it was about two-thirds of the platoon, half platoon, two-thirds of the platoon, and we set in. It was a long night. I do mean a long night. And everybody knew we were going to come back. And just in there, and you're just a long night. Dawn showed up, and Tennis says, man out. As we get back to the perimeter, the battalion commander standing there. Now, the lieutenant tells us, God bless Lieutenant Madison, you guys go to chow. And the colonel's yelling at him, what, were you all sleeping out there? Didn't you see anybody? Well, gee, I'm sorry, they didn't decide to come down our road. So that was it. But then, you know, then the day we had the big 1,200 rounds, the day they gave us the heaviest concentration of fire. I think that was the lightest day of injuries. I don't know if that makes sense or not. I don't know if it's true. To the best of my recollection, my platoon didn't take any wounded that day or killed, and I don't think anybody else did. because they were just coming all day. And, you know, you've been there. Artillery is more damaging, but rockets sound so bad. I don't think anybody could ever understand what a 120-millimeter rocket terrorized sound that is unless they get shot at with it. But, so they threw that in on us. And next day was almost as bad, but not as much. But, I don't really think anybody got wounded that day. And we saw a lot of Lieutenant Madison, Staff Sergeant James, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember the tomb guy's name. But you were basically, if you were, whatever your hold had, like my machine gun team had four people, that's who you dealt with. We had a lot of working parties, you know, where we would be digging holes and other stuff, which was a lot better off than the poor guys on 881 and 861. Because the night they hit, that's where they went for. They went for them. And God bless those poor guys. They did a great job. They held them. We pulsed them from 861, and it was hand to hand, knife to knife. They did it. They were just super. Remember, they were all 18-year-old kids, most of them, and that's what people have to remember. You know, we 18-year-old people can do that for their country. They should be given rights and privileges. But yeah, and they always did a great job. And then I never forget when the Army came in. The siege was over, you know, because you could tell we started playing football. I know that sounds like a terrible thing to say. You're not supposed to say that. We started to play football, and we had the first time I got sniped at, I actually thought it was a bumblebee. And I'm saying, what the hell is a bumblebee doing in Vietnam? And but it turned out to be a sniper. So we were playing football. And that must have really irritated them. But, you know, we're Marines and we're 18 years old and we're grunts and we're a case. And what are you going to do to us? And so we're throwing football and everybody said, okay, well, next time he shoots, it must have been 12 of us. We threw the ball. The guy shot and we all fell down. I think the guy had a heart attack. We never had another shot. But then the Army came in, and I never forget the Army guy. The Army guy, you know, I never saw so many staff sergeants in my life. All platoon sergeant was a staff sergeant. We had one. Then every other guy in the Army was a staff sergeant. And they all came in. And they were saying, they were relieving us by hole. So they come into our hole, we give it to them, we'd give them our fields of fire, our range card, and tell them what was going on. And here we are to attack 881 North. We can't even get a helicopter out. And the Army's coming and dropping one case of sea rations out with a helicopter and taking off. It was just in those days, Ueys were gunships for us. And these guys are just dropping sea rations. So it was funny. But the Army guys would say, they're leaving us in a hole. But this is just a hole. Hey, pretty good. Yeah. And then the Army guys got even with us because they were saying, hey, yeah, the officers club's opening up tonight. Yeah, we're going to have a USO show. You know, we're looking like this. But they're getting out of helicopters and they're getting helicopters dropping sea rations, 1K. We're figuring, hey, maybe this is it. Yeah, so we had to wait until we could get a helicopter to go fight the war. So we take off, and allegedly the division commander, the 1st Cavalry Division said, this place is filthy, and he started a police call. So I guess it was time for us to leave. But so we left, and we went up to 881. We were on 881, and we were there, and all of a sudden we were setting in that night, and one of the guys from the mortar spotters, the staff sergeant, a nice man, came by. And there was movement beneath us. And we had learned that a lot of rockets. And yet, you know, there is true stories about rock apes and Marines. You know, yes, the Marines have heard movement and you would throw a grenade and it would be a rock ape and a rock ape would pick it up and throw it back. And so, you know, sometimes you might think you're being in a firefight with Mr. Charles, but it might have been a record. But anyway, so we heard movement down there, so he says, and we got him over there, and he's hearing it, and he hears it, and he says, all right, we're going to call him orders. Okay, and he says, you guys are going to call him in. And that's how I learned how to call him orders, along with my buddy Chief Rodriguez and Barry Miller from the staff sergeant. That night we learned how to call in orders, and we called in orders in the going. And it was interesting. Next morning we're getting up, and we're going to go on the thing. And we were told it was going to be a raid situation. When we took 881 North, it was going to be a raid. And everybody said, that's great. That's the way it should be. Not that we had any choice. So all of a sudden, we're waiting, and everybody's passing us down first. You know, how you wait to fall in. And here's the new company commander. And it was very interesting. He's got an ammo box, a machine gun ammo box. And I say to myself, well, I'm a machine gun, and I got the gun. And I said, see, that's cool. The company commander's carrying ammo. And one of the guys looked at me like, he said, he ain't carrying ammo. He's got dirty laundry in there. I said, what? I don't even have any laundry. He's got dirty laundry? Yeah, because, you know, with the everybody got dysentery. And the sad part about being a caisson was, you know, there was no supply. So, you know how dysentery goes, and it's too late. What you did is you scraped it out and hoped for rain, and that's how you stayed. You didn't get no new, you know, but anyway. So that's why it was really frustrating when this schmuck has got dirty laundry, you know. So he goes, and so we get in there, and we set in, and the first thing we hear is the guy coming back saying, all right, machine guns are going to have to go in after the enemy machine gun nest. So Chief, Barry, and I. Now, Chief didn't smoke cigarettes until he heard that. Chief sucked on a whole bunch of cigarettes. Between the three of us, we finished a pack in 10 minutes. We just... So then we go up. So, of course, then we get online. We get home. And God bless the Marine Corps. We have my company. We have Kilo Company. India Company, I think, was in reserve. And we were Lima Company on the far end. And our battalion commander, Colonel Studd, is leading the charge. He's not doing anything. He's the man on... He's there. He's not in some helicopter up there. Look, he's with us. And the company commander of my company, who had done such a great fight up there when they attacked them, just got relieved, but he's doing all the coordinating on firearms with 106 rifles, artillery, aircraft, and mortars. And he did a superb job. He was Chesty Puller's son-in-law, but great guy. I mean, he was good. So what happens is we get online, only in America, I did a little right up the middle. So we go. And we're cursing and yelling and doing the things Marines do. And all of a sudden, I never forget, during the brief, they told us we didn't have to worry about any entrenched positions. Because aerial reconnaissance had said so. I went in the gully and I came up, and I'm telling you, I saw the biggest bunker I've ever seen in my life. It was half the size of this room this way, and it was as long as this room and as high as that ceiling. And it was in an opening. And I never believed the aerial reconnaissance in the next 24 years of my military career. But they swore it wasn't there. So I ran in and I ran right out shooting my machine gun. And we got up. So then we got up, and my platoon and I was in 2nd platoon. We were leading with 3rd platoon and general reserve with the company commander back there. So we went and we got just up to the last knoll. Next thing you know, in the middle of the attack, they stop us. Why they stopped us? So we get pulled to, so 1st and 3rd, 2nd platoon. So next thing you know, the company commander takes out his 45 with 3rd platoon, and the 3rd platoon commander says, charge. They go up the hill. The NVA were waiting. They were right there. They rolled Chi-Coms right down. Third platoon took a lot of casualties. Platoon sergeant went down right away. Most of the NCOs went down. Lieutenant Mass and Lieutenant Abram looked at each other and said, let's go. We went. Well, it was strange. We got to the top of the hill. 3rd Platoon was led by a busted corporal, who, needs to say after this, made corporal again. Good guy. And he got what was left of the platoon up the hill. We came and we reinforced him. And we're looking for the wounded and the dead, you know, when we're doing that. And we're doing this about 10, 15 minutes. All of a sudden, this lieutenant, the platoon leader, the 3rd Platoon, who had nobody has seen, all of a sudden, he shows up. Everybody's looking at him like... And I was up against a dead NVA soldier. My gun was down, and I'm using him as protection. And he's got his head blown off. And it was done by the 106 or by the mortar. Sorry for the guy, but it was a perfect shot. And it's obvious that the crown of his head is gone. You know, this idiot bayonets the guy. Says, only 3rd Herd gets souvenirs. Like, number one, who wants a souvenir? I only want out of here. My lieutenant looked at him like he was some kind of moron. And out of nowhere came the battalion commander, because he was with my company and Kilo Company and doing that. And he looked at him and he said, you'll relieve the command. He said, get down the hill. That, he did that to my company commander. And he told the lieutenant, you're out of here too. Boom. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, evidently they took an exit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. But, yeah, it was. And then the next day, what was very interesting is, you know, we took the hill and we brought the stuff back. And when we go on the assault, as you know in the Marine Corps, we go a high diddle up the middle, you drop your packs. Well, they took our packs. So God only knows where they went. But that's funny. That's another story. But they found a chopper that had gotten shot down weeks before during the siege. And our corpsman, who had been on R&R, was in there. And, you know, there was probably, I think, 18 passengers, and they were all dead and stuff. But at least they got their bodies recovered, which was a good thing. And so then we're leaving, and Sergeant Ernest is a good man. So now we were attached to Kilo for the night. So we're with Kilo Company, and we're between 881 North and 881 South on this knoll. And all of a sudden, the choppers are coming in to take us out. So, of course, when you're attached to another company, you're always the last schmucks to come out. And it's a C-40, so if the Chinook is a 47, these were 46s, these mm-hmm. C-9s. So they come in, and they're coming out. Next thing you know, just so they let us know they're still there, they drop mortars on us. So they hit a crowd, we go to the side, we return the fire. And Sergeant Ernest, God bless him, and he's another guy who's under 30. He's already gotten one tour in. He says, give me the and I said, what, Sergeant Ernest? He goes, give me the what, Sergeant Ernest? He goes, give me the MF laws. We had laws. But he had two in the back, so he couldn't understand something. But I seen him knock out 6 mortar positions in a half an hour. Sergeant Ernest was that good. And then this helicopter came. And now Sergeant James is there with us, the platoon sergeant. And we've got wounded, we've got dead, we've got equipment. And we ain't getting back. So we're just setting up ready for what's going on. I don't know where this chopper comes in. Boom, C-9. This major comes out and he's a pilot. And he says, I'm leaving this goddamn hill in 30 seconds with or without you. And well, we're very happy to see that. So we flew in the caisson. No, we didn't even land. Yeah, we flew in the caisson. And then we got off the helicopter, and then we got on another helicopter, and we flew to Quang Tri. When we got to Quang Tri, we landed, and the division band was there. And, you know, they played When the Saints Come Marching In, which is the standard, you put it, you know. And now you look at yourselves, because now you're in the rear, and, you know, you got all these people, they got clean clothes, they're washed. They shaved, they got haircuts. I know it. So the first thing they do is they let us eat. Now, this is the first time we've probably eaten good food in at least 80 days, if not more. So what happens? you're going to go through that whole thing about going to the bathroom again and all that stuff. But so, but we take our shower and they give us new uniforms. So they let us sleep by the airstrip in tents, which in hindsight was probably the biggest wrong to do, not by anybody else's part, but it was just wrong. And that night they hit us with mortars and rockets. We lost a lot of guys. And it was just Mr. Charles' way of saying, we'll see you again. And yeah, we were really down, a lot of people. But yeah, but that's the Khe-San thing.
Mm-hmm. And after Khe-San, how long was it before you ended up going back home?
Oh, geez. Well, we got a case on April, so I didn't get home till December.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was just my hello, how are you? That was, yeah, so I was like, you know, then we went on Operation Mamluk Thrust, which was a very big operation, and that's, and we cleared Charlie Ridge. I don't know if you know what Charlie Ridge was. Actually, our clearing of Charlie Ridge made the Red Star Army magazine in 1971, 72, or something like that. Because our battalion's tasking was to clear Charlie Ridge of all its rockets. That's where they had all the rockets for Da Nang and stuff. So we cleared it. That was a, you know, that was, one of the interesting thing about that was General Westmoreland had gone and General Labens now was the commander. So we're standing, you know, we're doing what we always did. Next thing you know, we don't have to move out this day. Why don't we have to move out this day? Because, you know, dumb grunts, you don't think about anything, but, you know, setting in, moving out on it. So, why don't we move? Next thing you know, we see Connex boxes. We've never seen Connex boxes being flown by helicopters before. They land. It's a mobile PX. We've never seen a mobile PX in our life. Never saw one again. We're getting number 10 cans of juice. We never got number 10 cans of juice before that we didn't rob, and we didn't get any after that we didn't rob. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, all these helicopters land. We got helicopters all around us. General Abrams comes out, and he's got all the staff. So, of course, he's got to have a Marine aide somewhere. Never forgot, these schmucks are walking around with M14s with slings. And you know, that's it. And so we just left. And I guess they were showing this is a typical Marine unit in the field. Ha ha. You know, but then, and of course, when he got his briefing and left, so did the Connex boxes. And so those other things. Oh, let me, if I can step back about one thing about Khe-San. Now, we get out of Khe-San, and that night that happened, so then they move us around to do different things in the area, and it's within a few days. All these Red Cross workers come out, you know, and they're all nice women, they come out. And our battalion commander's there, and he's got a lot of things on his mind, and he's handing out riding pads. You know, it's a 3rd Marine Division of riding pads. He hand them out, and he says, I want you to write your wife, your mother, or whoever your next of kin is, I just want them to know that you're out of Khe-San and you're alive and well. And then you can say anything you want. You know, you can say, I hate the Marine Corps, I hate me, or whatever, I don't care. But just let them know you're safe and stuff. So we do that. You know, because you know, mail wasn't a priority. So we do that. He collects them up. He turns them over to this pretty girl. And then the next thing is she collects all the writing pads and takes off. I'm not a big fan of the Red Cross for a lot of reasons. That was one of them. Where's the dumb grunt gun? You can't go to the PX, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, if you could go to the PX, you ain't got no funny money. You know, so yeah, it was just amazing. But yeah, the Red Cross is notorious for that. Yeah, well, you know, but yeah, so. But anyway, so yeah, so we did that. So, but that was a good thing. So they left, and we did our operation, and I was going on and on. So I got called out, and in the Marine Corps, they told you where you were going for on and on. They told me I was going to Okinawa. I said, but First Sergeant, I don't want to go to Okinawa. I just came from Okinawa. And he very nicely told me I had no say in the matter. You're going to Okinawa. I said, but I want to go to Australia. He said, only officers go to Australia. Okay. Well, next thing you know, he says, hey, Ella, you're going to Australia. What? Yeah, go get your gear. So I get my gear, and the guy, and we get on this chopper, and this guy from my company gets on his chopper. And meantime, he had a company clerk. You know, nobody likes company clerks. And his company clerk, very mousy kid, says, "Oh, yes, First Sergeant. I'm ready to go." He says, "You ain't going nowhere. I'll see you in 30 days. And he left him out in the bush. That was cool. But Colonel Stutt did the same thing. During the siege of Kaysan, when we were losing people, and, you know, we lost a lot, he would replace him with, you know, he really believed every Marine was a rifleman. And what he did is that clerk I told you about that said, "And you don't want me to see your name because I send the letters home?" Well, he came to spend many a night in my machine gun position because we were short people. Yeah, he learned a different respect. But it turned out well because we had cooks do it and all this other stuff. So when they went back to their primary jobs after about 2.5-3 months, when you came in, you were no longer treated like trash. And because you know how everybody treats mm-hmm. you, grunt. No, everybody wants to be you, but nobody wants to be with you. You know, so he did that. But when we got down, I got down, and I had a report to the sergeant major. And our sergeant major and our colonel was always in the tree line with us. They were always in the bush. They weren't like these guys. They were there, but he came in. And we had a report to him, and he's fixing up this hooch, and he's got this wireman there and this other radio guy, and we report in, and he says, "Where are you from, Corporal?" And he says, "My company." So he says, "Where are you from, ALO?" And I said, "Lima Company." He says, "All right, you, who's senior here?" This corporal's not stupid. He says, "I am." He says, looks at the other guy and says, "Okay, you're going to replace my company. Be on this strip in 20 minutes. I'll take you out." He goes, "Don't worry, ALO, we're going to cook for you." As soon as that landline works up, get me to cook. Yeah, and the sergeant major took a cook and another guy and a wireman out for replacements, one-on-one. That's how it was. And so we get into Da Nang that night, and everybody's looking at us. We don't know why they're looking at us. And we eating this food, and it was really good. And we're eating it, and the guy's giving us all the food we want, and we're eating. But we notice people are moving away from us. We don't understand why people are moving away from us. And the reason they're moving away from us is because we stink to high heaven. We've been in the jungle for 40, 50 days. So, you know, we had a terrible smell. And that was like, oh, okay. So we did that. And then I went back and we flew up to Quang Tri because that's where our battalion rear was. And we get there and First Sergeant comes in. He says, "ALO, what's going on out in the field?" And I'm only a PFC. I've been a PFC for a long time. In fact, I was the senior PFC in the battalion. I had status. And all of a sudden, he said, "What's going on, ALO?" And I told him what's going on in the field. I told him the guys are doing a great job and what was going on and stuff. He gave me my one allocated shot of hooch that he had in his thing. And then it was, "Okay, now when you get done, I want you to go take a shower, go get your hair cut, go get a set of new utilities, and report back to me at 1300. And, you know, you don't say anything but yes, First Sergeant. So I go on. I go to supply side and he tells me to go away. Typical supply side. I go, so I don't have any towel to take a shower, but I know I'm taking a shower. I don't have any clothes. So I take a shower and I wipe myself off with my uniform. You know, and I'm the only private in the Marine Corps who does that. Everybody does that. So I go to the barbershop. Barbershop says it doesn't open to 1400, so I got to be back at 1300. So I go back, report to the First Sergeant. Of course, the First Sergeant has a baby. Why am I not? And I told him. He said, "Come with me." So, you know, I'm not walking left and abreast with the First Sergeant, I'm walking behind him. He goes to the supply tent and he looks at the supply sergeant and he says, "You're out of here. Pack your gear, you're going to the bush." Corporal Bruno, who used to be my squad leader and who had many Purple Hearts and was a good guy, he says, "Bruno, you're now the supply sergeant. Give this guy a uniform." So Corporal Bruno gave me my uniform. So and then he says, "Hey, ALO, don't cause no more problem." I go, "I'm sorry." Yeah, so what happened? Well, I forgot where it was. I apologize. But
you're telling about.
So the First Sergeant says, "Don't cause no more problems." So I go. Get my hair cut and everything else, and I go on and on. I have a great time. I go to Australia. Great, great, great time. I come back to the rear, and I guess I had my malaria during that incubation time, between the time I got there, the time I went on, the time I got back. Well, the first night I'm back, I get my malaria attack. And I fall out of the tent, and God bless Corporal Bruno, he finds me. He picks me up, and he brings me to the corpsman's tent. Now, the corpsman at the battalion aid station, they're all new people, and they ain't never been to the bush. They were in that caisson. They don't know nothing. Because, you know, the corpsman, God bless them, they did 6 months in the bush, 6 months at battalion aid station. And some they rotated either way. The officers did 6 months in the bush and then the rest of the time in the rear. The only grunts in the Marine Corps who stayed out there were the staff NCOs and you. And all of a sudden, this young kid says, "What's he on, drugs?" And he said, "This guy doesn't even drink." You know what I'm talking about? And so, you know, I had my malaria. And they caught it very early, and it was in the, you know, so I did that. I was all right. Then I went back out to the field. And, you know, we did a really good thing. And then I remember coming back, and we got a brand new first lieutenant. And this guy was an MP. And now I'm back at Da Nang. We're all ready to go back out. Sergeant Major's there. Sergeant Major says, "Hey, Al, you want to go back to Australia?" I said, "Sergeant Major, I got no money." He says, "I didn't say that. I'll lend you $500. Do you want to go to Australia?" I said, "No, Sergeant Major. Thank you, but I can't." So anyway,
I'm going to stop you right here. First Sergeant offered to pay your way to Australia.
Sergeant Major. It was a battalion Sergeant Major, big deal. You know? No, thank you. So we're going to go out. So we're going to go back to the unit. So now we're going to go convoy, which is fine, but we're going to convoy by anthrax, amphibious strike. Cool. So all of a sudden there's a new lieutenant because they had brought over all these people. Now they needed we needed replacements because we had none. And we had used up a whole lot during caisson. And then after we got out of caisson, now we didn't have a priority anymore. Now they needed to give us more bodies. So they disbanded one of the MP battalions. So we got an MP officer. And we thought we were being nice. You know, we were filling up at the water buffalo canteens, and we said, "Hi, Lieutenant," or "Good morning, sir," something like that. And this schmuck said, "Take the cigarette out of your mouth and salute me." So we made sure we saluted him in the field, too. But yeah, he was a schmuck. He didn't last long. Our company commander ate him. We got a very good, when they got rid of that one captain, the next lieutenant, company commander we got, Gunnery Sergeant Brewster, Major Bennett was the company commander. The best Marines you ever met in your life. They were both enlisted guys before this. And they worked as drill instructors together for years. They were the epitome of the Marine Corps, and they didn't have. In fact, the first time I make any booster, he was going to kill me, and I knew he would have. But, you know, when you get out of caisson, you really think you were a bad guy. You know, I was like, "Yeah, what are you going to do to me? I fought the big battle," you know what I mean? And I came back on a one-day sweep on a convoy, and I got into the bunker, and the guy said, "Hey, the new gunny came by, and he said, you better put straighten up your gear rail, and it looked right, it looked terrible, and he was going to do it." I said, "Listen, just tell him this ain't the drill field. He ain't no drill sergeant anymore, da, da, da." About that time, he ate me up. And nicest man you ever want to be. Gunny Brewster, the first guy in a firefight, great man. Major Bennett, even better. They were just that good. But anyway, back on that, yeah, so they really did. They really did well. So we go out on this thing, and so we do the convoy that night, and we set in, and then the rest of, and what they did was for the insertion, it was a nifty insertion. You know how normally when you insert people, they drop choppers, and you know, the NVA work, and say, "Oh, they just made an insertion there, so you know they're there." We inserted them, we took them with us, and we dropped off recon teams behind us, which was a very smart thing, and we kept on going. And The amphrax left, we did our operation. This was in Elephant Valley, which is north of Da Nang. And we were in Elephant Valley, now we're clearing that out. And we're going, and nothing really special about good old Elephant Valley, but the worst mosquitoes I've ever felt with in Vietnam had to be in Elephant Valley. Worst. I mean, they were as big as this table, and they pick you up. They just tap you on the shoulder and say,
becoming easier the hard way. You know what I mean? It was just terrible. But yeah, but we did.
And we were doing one day sweeps, and we got back and we were doing one day sweeps, and they put us up in Foolock. Now, Foolock was north of Da Nang, by the Haibon Pass, north of, and what evidently during Tet, the NVA had cut off the Haibon Pass on either end, and they really just destroyed the villages. They did terrible things to them. And what was interesting about that was we went on our first patrol, little patrol. We were leaving the 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, great outfit. They were the guys who took away with 1-1. 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, can't get better than that. Those guys should get all the credit. So we see this old blown-up schoolhouse. We know it's a blown-up schoolhouse because it's actually got a blackboard in there. And it said, "Welcome 326 and goodbye 25. It was amazing. It was just amazing. Probably the guy did, but you know, nobody knows. But yeah, we were there, and it was very interesting. We had an interesting time there. And one of the things that was interesting about it was about 5:30 that night, we got a lieutenant shows up. In the interim, we had a motor T officer as a lieutenant too, as a platoon leader. Good guy, he's trying, but he's motor transport officer. Next thing you know, he says, "I'm the new lieutenant." And there's something strange about this guy. He looks a little bit older, you know? He doesn't have that typical second lieutenant look. So they bring up, I get on the radio and I call over to the company because we're on a platoon patrol basis. And I said, "We got, you know anything about a new lieutenant?" And they said, "There's no new lieutenant, he's a turncoat." Because remember, we had to deal with turncoats. You remember that. You remember what they did at Marble Mountain in 68. And that was just happened, so everybody was looking for him. So they said, "Battalion knows nothing about him. Snatch him up and take him to the battalion. Put an M16 on him." They drive him off to battalion. Hey, I'm a hero. I caught a turncoat. I can see the citation now. I'm thinking, this has got to be good for a 3-day R&R. I am knowing this is great. What happens? It was your old, we forgot to tell you. This was Lieutenant Hoover. He's been a Mustanger. He had 12 years on the drill field. He came back. He was a very good man. He actually promoted me to corporal. But yeah, he came in and he walked up and he told the lieutenant, "Pack your gear, the jeep's waiting for you to get out of here." He came over and he did a very interesting thing. We had the LPs out. And what he did was he opened up with an M79. You remember an M79. Mm-hmm. And he'd fire over out of the danger zone so nobody would get hit at DLP with the M79 fragmentation. You know, nobody ever went to sleep anymore on that LP. And we were doing what they called killer teams. You take a patrol out. Say that we call it the afternoon patrol. You take the afternoon patrol out. Four-man killer team, one machine gun, squad leader, or assistant squad leader, but patrol leader, two riflemen, and you'd set in, and you were a mobile ambush. You would go all night long. What would happen is they copied this from the British. If we made contact, we'd do a ring of fire. They'd surround us with mortars, artillery, and we'd keep on moving. And you had to be at preset locations at preset times. Well, don't be the patrol that thought they were going to sandbag. And the sandbag patrol was, as you know, you wouldn't move from position and everybody would go to sleep except for one guy. And that was not a sandbagging patrol. Well, we didn't have to worry about that because Lieutenant Hoover ensured that that didn't happen. Because he'd call an artillery on the position you had just left and you'd better be where you were because the only safe place you were was where you were supposed to be. And so he taught us, he was very good, he taught us a lot what we did. And but we had to, and one of the other strange replacements we got was this staff sergeant. And we're in Dodge City now, and this was in July, we're in Dodge City. Now, Dodge City is a mean place. And we're doing a reconnaissance kind of thing. Not a whole battalion's there, but we're doing a reconnaissance. And next thing you know, we see this new platoon sergeant we got. And we're saying, gee, he's trying. I mean, he's got the wrong camouflage on, but he's, you know, he's got the camouflage on his pack. Next thing you know, Lieutenant comes over, punches him, and throws the stuff on his back. We're 19 years old. We're from New York. We're the heroes of KSAP. None of us knew that this idiot was drying out marijuana. Oh, yeah. So, boom, boom, boom. So, Hoover did. So, he dumped this schmuck. And all of a sudden, we're going on and going on. We're getting a lot of fire, a lot of fire, a lot of fire. And that night we set in, and I never forget, they fired at us from underneath us. They were in the perimeter underneath us. And we had a guy who had malaria, and he had it real bad. And you know how malaria hits, bang. Well, you know, and the Marine Corps choppers don't come out at night. And God bless the corpsman, they worked this guy all night, and they saved his life. First night, they took him out. And that next day, we're humping again. And water, very hot, very hot, because it's flat. Well, you look like it must have, and we're talking miles and miles and nothing but old dried out rice paddies. And in the middle of it was a Rock Marine outpost. And we had gone in, we're coming back, and top patrol. And you know, the Marine Corps always believed in having a pilot on the ground with you. So here's this, you know, we're walking, and we just happened to be by the colonel. And he says, I need the air officer. Where is he? Oh, he's back there. Now, this pilot was in typical, I mean, he could probably do a triathlon, you know what I mean? But he couldn't hump. You know how people can't hump? His boy could not hump. He comes running up, and the colonel says, he takes his hands out of the ring, and he beats him like a dog. He says, where are you when I need you? Boom, 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 boom. And we're going, you know what? Nobody felt sorry because he should have been there. And so he calls in, and he gets the fighter aircraft. And that's, remember the OV-10s? They were brand new. I never forget, the guys came down, a guy came down swooping, and we're thinking it's like that old P-38, because that's what it looked like. And he threw cigarettes to us. We thought, oh, thank God, this is a great guy. And all of a sudden, Charlie, stupid as he is sometimes, opened up on him. But unlike the Piper Cubs, he could fight back. And I guess Charles thought he was a Piper Cub. He wasn't, as you know. He opened up with that machine gun. It made his day all bad. But, yeah, so then we do that. And, yeah. Then we went to Anwar. And I never forget going to Anwar. We went on a 5-day mission looking for 10 turncoats. We didn't walk past 2 o'clock in the afternoon at all. No time did we walk past 2 o'clock. And we set in. And we had strict orders. If anybody came over to us from the right or two from the left, from the rear, or from the front and spoke English, we would shoot them. Because don't trust nobody, because we were looking for 10 turncoats. And we found base camps and all the other stuff, but we never found them. So we left. But those are the guys who did Monkey Mountain and Marble Mountain, where one guy dressed up as a major in Special Forces, and he was a turncoat. He wasn't really a major, he really wasn't Special Forces. And then he cut the wire. And what happened was that night, Mr. Charles came in. Well, he had cut the wire, and they blew up 13 helicopters, I think. But yeah, so it was very, yeah. So we did that. We went down, and of course we did Mead River. Mead River was again in Dodge City. I think we had found so much stuff in Dodge City that then they planned the operation around that. Later on, that was July. That was my last operation in December. But yeah, and then I went home. I got home in December of, I left 12 December. 1968, and I never forget getting on that plane. Two things. One, I saw my junior drill instructor, who was a real pain in the butt, really mean, nasty guy. You know what his job was in the Marine Corps? To put you on a plane. Thank you a lot, bud. But there was a guy named Rodriguez, and they made poor Rodriguez's life miserable when he was at boot camp. And they told him how he was going to die in Vietnam. Rodriguez was carrying 4 AK-47s on his shoulder. And, you know, that meant that he killed. Those AK-47s, they were his. He learned them the hard way. So making a long story short, yeah, then we went back to Okinawa, then we landed in El Toro, and it was just simply amazing. I never forget it. We were taxiing up and some very bored 01 came, we had an admin guy, you know, a little Lance Corporal, came onto the plane and was going very bored that he had to give this speech. On behalf of wonderful people, welcome back to Vienna, and all that nonsense. And you could see all these officers and wives and senior NCOs' wives who were stationed in Camp Pendleton or were out there waiting to see him. And he says, and nobody will jump over the white fence because they'll be in trouble. Yeah. So what happens as soon as the door opens, the majors and the colonels and the captains and the sergeant majors and the staff sergeants jump over the fence and they see the Romans. But the flight Anna Da Nang was the most... The stewardess later said she never got over the fact that when the guys left, especially the Marines, when they left Da Nang, it was silent all the way to Okinawa. It was just, that's just how it was. And we got there, and then they stand there, and the guy says, we get on the line, you know, they give us these little cards. Remember the Hong Kong flu? Guy says, yeah, you'll keep these bonds retirement at all time. Why? Because if you fall out, the health department will know where you came from. That's why. Okay. So then he tells us about the Hong Kong flu. And, of course, we got blamed for the Hong Kong flu. So then we get on the line. And the guy's standing there, and he goes, and there's where you're getting your real orders. You get orders to get out of the country. Now you're going to get your real orders. And he says, okay, you're going to the 2nd Marine Division. Okay. Camp Lejeune. I said, fine. Like I had a choice. And he says, how you going? Now, I bought a first-class ticket in Freedom Hill in Da Nang. The only time I ever flew first class in my entire life. But leaving Vietnam, I was going to go first-class plane ticket home from California. And so did my buddy Jimmy Hughes, who's from New York, too. And he says, okay. He says, no, you're not. You're going by train. I said, no, I'm not. I'm going by plane. I got a ticket. He goes, no, listen. You get extra travel time if you go by train. Because he asked me what unit I was in Vietnam, and I told him. He said, oh, okay, you're going by train. So my buddy's behind him, and he says, and how are you going home? He says, I'm going home by train. He says, no, you're not. You're going home by airplane. That's just, yeah. So we got up there, and I never forget, we got to the airport. And I'm not even in the country 2 hours yet. And we go to the bar. And we sit there at the bar, and the first thing is a bartender, and this guy must be 23 years old. He says, can I help you guys? He says, yeah, can we have a beer? You can't have a beer, you're not old enough. We're both corporals. We're 19. All right. Can we have a soda? Because you know, you don't want to be a drunk. Yeah, but you can't have it at the bar. You got to sit at the table. So then we go to a restaurant. So you know what you want to eat. So I got an egg salad sandwich and a french fries and a strawberry milkshake. And I forget what Jim got. And we had the rudest, nastiest, rottenest waitress you'd ever imagine. And she was really rude. And when we left, I gave her a $20 tip. Jimmy gave her $20. She was shocked. We're talking 1968, $20 around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. $20, that's $40. That's a whole week's whatever. So she was shocked. We got, so we're walking down the airport, and there's a college kid with his wife and a brand new baby. And we're walking down. You know how you could sit right outside? I mean, you know, there was the entrance way to the airport. Mm-hmm. We go and we walk in. So we go to sit, and this lady screams, and in the middle of the walkway, ooh, baby killers. I mean, they did that. I mean, you know, that was just unbelievable. And, you know, we didn't do anything. And when we went, now we already had first class tickets, so as soon as we got there, we went up to the counter. The lady told us to go back in line. Of course, it's a long line. We finally get there 20 minutes later. She said, why didn't you get in line the first time? You're first class, you don't have to wait. But that was the kind of, that was the negative side. But like I said, the reason I enjoyed the service, I stayed in the service, and I don't think the reason I didn't have any problems, or most of my friends didn't have any of their problems, is because we stayed in the service. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sam, you want us to leave?
Yeah, they're closing up.
Oh, are they? Okay. Well, thank you very much for your interview.
Yeah. Anytime.
Okay.